The following program is intended for mature audiences.
You're listening to Bottom Shelf Recording Talk.
Sounds boring.
Oh my, yeah.
With your hosts, James Seabrook.
Okay, you were paying attention, but the idea is clear in my head, but translating it into English is not. That's brutal. I understand the hypocrisy.
And Joey Roach.
I don't even know what you do. I was just told you were the man. Some people would say I'm overconfident. That could be my ego talking, though.
I'm trying to think of the right word.
Oh. Yeah. Must be a tough word. Next subject.
You're bored with this one?
You don't hear us gassing on about it.
Keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
By the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories,
you have a big mouth.
Here's a good idea.
What are you even talking about?
Have a point.
Why are you airing personal matters with complete strangers?
It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
But that was largely because you started pricing yourself out and you guys were having a lot of fighting.
No, I didn't start pricing myself out until after like a 6-month period where he didn't hire me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm. After 6 months of, like, he didn't call me once. Mm-hmm. Like, in the first 3 or 4 months that I was working for him, it seemed like I was going there 2-3 times a week and getting paid $20 an hour plus $20 for travel expenses. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really have that much travel expenses.
Right.
Unless I took a cab.
Yeah. Right.
And then plus he would buy me food while I was working there.
Which is nice. But food, that doesn't help you pay bills.
But then I had 6 months where I wasn't getting work from him, despite the fact that I was supposed to be his in-house engineer. Right. And he was just getting the in-house guitarist / teacher.
to do all the things.
Yeah. Just do demos and stuff, despite the fact that our agreement was I did all of the recording. That's what I agreed to. So after that 6 months is like, I'm already bitter because I've been saying no to projects because I have to keep my schedule open to go on this guy's beck and call whenever he wants it.
Right.
Because he didn't hire me for 6 months. I was starting to get more projects again. And then he called me and he was getting upset with me because I had other commitments that I had to go with. And it's just like, there's a disconnect where he didn't understand that if you don't call me on a regular basis, I'm going to go elsewhere and look for other things.
It almost sounds like he doesn't understand business and employees, you know, like.
Well, he's a guy who spent like his entire career working in the multi-million-dollar sphere of business.
Okay.
So it's people with like huge salaries and stuff like that. So like if they don't work for 6 months, they don't care because they probably have like 20 years of income already in their bank account.
Right. I had an uncle like that would trades, but I think he was one of those instrumentologists or something. It's not the right word.
Something very specialized?
Yeah, something more specialized. And not a guy on the ground.
Mm-hmm. The office space guy who gets paid a lot of money, kind of.
No, he'd be more like the control room guy in a plant site.
Oh.
That would fix all the control room stuff and make the computer networks functional and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He got laid off early 50s.
Okay.
From whatever like full-time job he'd had for 20 years or something.
Right.
And then just started contracting, and he would take, you know, 3 months here and make huge money, and then they'd go on 6-month vacation, you know, and then 3 months there and he'd make huge money and he'd go on 6-month vacation. And he did that, by the sounds of it, he did that for, I don't know, another 10 or 12 years before he finally just decided he didn't want to work anymore. Yeah. Well, and I mean,
granted, on him,
like one of the
kind of money,
one of those contracts, was way up north at, there's that diamond mine,
okay.
Way up north, like northern, Northwest Territories ish.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was totally isolated, like fly in, fly out type of thing, right?
Yeah, so
and
they pay for his expenses to be there.
Exactly.
In the first place.
He did something similar down in, I can't remember if it was Utah or Texas, but somewhere down south where it was a highly specialized thing that he was brought in for. And mm-hmm. and he was locked in for, you know, 3-4 months, right? So
yeah.
So those were the kind of contracts that he would take, something that it's a lot of work, it's a lot of time, but it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And local stuff, less fruitful stuff. I just don't think he was interested. And I can understand that. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Regardless, this guy I'm talking about, it's clear he had a lot of money because he had like pretty much bought a house and renovated it to be a let's teach guitar to kids space.
Right.
And then got the idea that he wanted to convert some of that house into
a little recording studio.
And I did my best. And unfortunately, he just had expectations from me that just didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And so I started to price myself out. And it wasn't until I hit $120 an hour that he got rid of me.
Yeah, right?
Which awesome. I'm surprised it got to that point because who the hell in Edmonton's making that much money recording, right?
Well, there's a couple of the big studios, their corporate prices are that. In that range.
Well, I mean, that's...
I know, but that's not you.
And that's also corporate work. Corporate places can have that kind of money and they're expecting like top-notch quality. And
the highest musician rate that I've heard in the city since we opened here in 2010 was $95 an hour. And there were two studios that were charging that. It was Power Sound.
Yeah.
They were... 125 or they were 95
mm-hmm.
and
that's studio with engineer though.
Yeah, that's right. That's studio with engineer. That's specifically to work with Phil, right?
Yeah.
And he comes with his long list of credentials. And then, it was called, Black Man Productions, Perry Blackman.
Okay.
He very lesser known studio. They didn't do a lot of music work.
Right.
It was more like a hobby-ish thing for them when they did music work. They were a video production company that owned a lot of real estate. Uh-huh. I don't know if they still have it because it's been a long time since I've talked to them, but they had a beautiful video production suite and a small... It was like two of this size room for their audio production suites. And mostly they would do Foley mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. And they do all their own audio production for the videos. But every once in a while, they do a music project.
That sounds like a video production place that just occasionally did music and mm-hmm. thus charged the same price they charge for movie production.
And I think their movie production or their corporate rates were a lot higher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Corporate rates are always higher because the company can afford it.
Yeah. This brings up an interesting conversation that Roland and I have been having the last 3 days.
Okay.
I take that back, the last 2 days, today being the third, because we're going to continue the discussion today. And I don't think he's going to listen to this podcast, so I'm going to talk really poorly
All right.
about him.
I'm sure you just tell him everything we talk about anyway.
I don't. You know what? I don't. Outside of the show, I really don't talk about the show other than to complain about how little we prepare for the show.
But that's on both of us.
I know. I know. Half of it is complaining about myself. Half of it is complaining about you. And, you know, that's
at least you're open about complaining about me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I complain about you to you. So mm-hmm. it's not like... anyway, so this conversation that we've been having is... Roland has been trying to... He's been on his introduction price for over a year now.
Okay.
And he's finally ready to raise the price. So he's trying to figure out what price he should raise to, and asking a lot of questions, but they were all the wrong questions. And it took us about a day for me to figure out that he was actually asking the wrong questions. Mm. And I started asking him, because he was taking the perspective that what his clients are willing to pay or think is a fair price should be what his price is.
No.
Right. And so once I realized that that's the perspective that he was taking, I started asking the right question. Like, what do you know about your competitors? What do you know about the people that you are competing directly for work? Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of engineers that he's been competing directly for a lot of his clients. And what are you, what is your place within that market of your competitors?
Yeah.
Excuse me. And so I sent him home, and we haven't really talked about his results. Yesterday was a gong show of a day. But I sent him home Sunday night to do a whole bunch of homework.
Yeah.
And I actually phrased it like that. And he actually discovered a whole bunch of his competitors, started to understand their pricing structures.
Yeah.
And isn't asking the question what he should raise his price anymore. He's figured it out by just doing this research.
Yeah.
You made it onto his list, by the way.
Did I?
Yeah. Yeah. We decided to classify his competition, and I do this myself, but his competition into A-level competitors, B-level competitors, and C-level competitors, and you're right. A C-level competitor, but you're on that list.
Okay.
It's so like you don't really pose a lot of, there's not a lot of overlap.
No.
But it is worthy of paying attention to what that level of competitor does.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm on the list too as a C-level competitor, just because my prices are so low.
But does he even know what I charge?
Yeah, roughly.
Okay.
Yeah. He and I have talked about it, and you and I have talked about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you just pretty much gave him my information about what I charge.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the thing, right?
Yeah.
Although
I'm going to probably change my structure a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing you always want to, if you're paying attention to your competitors, you always want to keep in mind that their prices could change at any minute.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not always up.
Well, I'm thinking of changing my structure to be a more on a project base, and it's going to be like quoting project by project.
Yeah. Are you, how do you plan on accounting for musician, the differences of project to project? Maybe I'm asking the wrong question. Speaking of wrong questions, lay that out for me. Like, what do you have in mind for
well, I'm going to keep, like, in my head, I'm going to keep my current kind of price structure
right
available, but I'm going to start negotiating on a project by project basis, and I'm going to actively be trying to see what the band's budget is for the project and what they're expecting for that money.
Right.
So if, like, for example, band A wants to do 10 songs and they have $10,000 to do it, like, that's a pretty healthy budget.
Right.
I'm just going to be like, yeah, okay, we'll do it.
Yeah, right.
But like band B, they have, let's say $1,000 and they want to do 10 songs. Then I'm going to talk to them and be like, well, that's a little unrealistic. Let's see. Yeah. What we can do for $1,000. Let's see what works for you.
Sure.
Like, do you need editing? If not, like, I can cut that part out of my normal my normal budgeting and give you
right
a price that takes out editing, kind of thing.
Gotcha.
Or you don't need recording. Well, that's a huge cut in price that, like, we don't need to worry about that.
Right. Are you going to, this is one of the things I struggle with when I'm quoting on projects, is understanding how long something will take, to record. I can usually understand how long it'll take to edit, and I can usually understand how long it'll take to mix. Those are Those are easy to quantify time-wise, but the recording process is hard for me to quantify. And so I struggle in keeping that.
I try to
aligned.
Just average what I think it will take and then add 50%.
Okay. All right. And that way, if you come under budget, you save them money, right?
Like that way, I quote them the 150% time that I think it'll take to do the project. But let's say we don't use that extra time.
Yeah,
I'm going to take the money from that and put it towards the other parts. And then the overall price of the project's going to go down. And I'm going to actively tell them, like,
gotcha.
Hey, we recorded that song a lot quicker. We recorded everything a lot faster than I thought we would.
So we saved.
So I just saved you
10%.
Like,
or whatever.
I'd probably give them like a dollar of value amount and be like, mm-hmm. I saved you $500.
Right.
Which I'm going to currently throw towards the post-production stuff. And then whatever we have left over, I'm just going to give back or probably just not charge you for.
That's fair.
Yeah.
So
that's the current way I'm thinking of doing it is I'm going to be trying to figure out what my average price is.
Right.
I'm not going to say overcharge, but overestimate the cost to kind of get it so that the band is in the mindset of like, okay, it's going to cost this much. And then when I save the money because we don't hit that point, you know, I look like the hero, I guess, in a sense.
Yeah, right.
Like I'm adding value to the project by trying to make it so that they spend less money than I quoted them.
I ended up going a slightly different route than that, but I'm essentially trying to accomplish the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have three different options for how you want to record, right?
Yeah.
I have my live in studio, which I have over the next 3 or 4 months, I have a handful of live projects I'm so excited about.
Because you did the Forge thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Did you hear about that
or did I tell you about that? Thing on the Facebook saying that Two Bodies of Water Productions is going to give the winner, but then I know somebody who is playing that show.
Oh, sweet.
Which who got second place?
Oh, so let me find that cuz I was just talking to Matt last night. Second place was Mitch Vermeer.
Okay. Well, the bass player for them that band is my department manager.
Oh, sweet. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That'll be a lot of fun. Yeah. So,
and he's all like, hey, I'm looking forward to it. I would normally just record my own thing, but if I got the free time, I'm going to take advantage of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm looking at it as much as for fun as for anything, right? Yeah. If he normally does his own thing, I imagine he'll end up asking for the multi-tracks. Yeah. Right. And then, that could just be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Right. So I have the live in studio thing. Then I have the 1 day of recording thing, where, and again, like the idea is I control all the variables, right?
Yeah.
And then I also have the radio ready thing where it's a much higher price per song, but we take as much time as we need ish.
Yeah.
And I do whatever I can to make it sound right.
Yeah.
You know, and I've done that with a lot of clients where they don't know what they need. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of identify this is the most I'll charge you. If we end up going beyond this, I'm just going to cap it at this and we'll make it work.
Yeah.
Right. For clients that have that kind of money, then that's, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm somewhat trying to do of that approach where I do the per project thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if I end up underestimating with my overestimation, I'm going to eat the cost of that.
Which is fair. And what's his nuts? Kenny Joya from the formerly of Groove 3 and, or maybe still Groove 3.
Yeah, he still does Groove 3, and he does a lot of different things.
Yeah, I know him from Mixed Notes from Hell.
Yeah. I know him from arguing with Mixer Man all the time.
Fuck.
Those are great.
Who seems like the more right guy?
They're both right for different reasons.
Fair enough. But he,
and besides, Kenny Joya is just a shit disturber anyway. He will fucking take a stick and hit the hive.
Yeah.
He's That's that awesome. Kind of person. That's and awesome. He's just doing it for fun. Like he understands the arguments that are being made. He knows that they're not wrong. He's just poking and prodding to get people.
Nice.
Like he's just that kind of person. He's like you in a sense. Just like I'm going to disagree because and I
far
enjoy
more
having
successful of me. Yeah. So I think that per project thing works a lot better for musicians because it's easier for them to digest the math. Right? It's this much per song. It's this
and
much
I can
per
break it down too if they want it further broken down and be like, well, I'm estimating about this much time in the studio to record the project.
Yeah.
And then I'm estimating this much time to do editing, this much time to do the mix, and maybe if I'm mastering I'm also editing or I'm estimating this much time here. I charge this, so that's how I get this number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That sounds like a great way to go. I when I get around to redoing my website again, which will happen hopefully by Christmas, I think I'm going to focus on that per song pricing structure.
Well, I want to go a per project basis and not necessarily a per song, because if a band's going to hire me for an entire record, the great thing about that is because I am going to be overestimating and my timeline for each song is going to be the same.
Yeah.
But the thing is like when you're working on several songs, you're going to get quicker on some things.
Yeah. Some songs take longer. Some songs are much
shorter. So those songs that take longer, I'm taking budget from the other songs, putting them towards them. And the ones that take shorter, like they just help the overall project.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But at the end of the day though, it's just easier for the bands to do the math in advance. And this is why, I mean, you and I disagree with this slightly or disagree on this point slightly, how to display those prices, right? Like I want my prices right on the website. Here's the variable. This is,
I used to do that
and style of recording. And then here is, you know, if you want to do the math on how much an album is going to be.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I used to do that and I see the merits in doing that, but from my own experience doing that, I've had a lot of people underestimating how much time it takes to record.
Well, but that's why I put specific limitations on.
Well, I had minimums and stuff.
But I mean maximums, right? Like it's not a minimum cost. It's this price gives you this specific amount of time in the studio. And that is something that I can control and make sure that we stay on target.
Yeah.
Right. And then if we go beyond that, it's a very clear and easy delineation to see. This is where we're going beyond. This is how much it's going to cost per hour beyond what you've paid. If you want to go down that road, that's an easy thing to think about for the band, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and then it's all within my control, right?
That's fair.
You know, and I'm specifically, especially on my live in studio and the one song, one day packages, I'm eating a lot of that cost, right? Like I'm giving them a discount on my time anyway.
Right.
Oh, excuse me. That was right into the microphone. I apologize. I'm giving them a discount on that time anyway, so I don't mind saying these are the limitations. This is what you get. And if we need more, it's going to cost you. Oh, goodness. This is why I wasn't going to make coffee if you already had coffee, but I am really enjoying it. I'm sorry. Anyway, I think those limitations are a really good foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when people ask me, I even have a pre-written little list of what those things are. So I don't have to write it out every time. But when people ask me, I make sure I'm very clear. These are good guidelines and starting points.
Yeah.
And if things need to vary, we can certainly vary them. But for you doing the math at home, this is how you base it.
Yeah.
And it's like when we had that conversation with Scott Green, I wish we could have got him on the podcast, but when we had that conversation with Scott Green, he was very adamant that musicians have trouble thinking in terms of hourly,
yeah,
but they very easily think in terms of a day. You know, how much can you get done in a day?
Yeah.
And so that that reaffirmed that this kind of pricing structure that I have isn't crazy. it probably is, but
well, that's more or less what I'm gonna be doing, is just being like, well, you want to record 3 songs. I'm estimating that it'll probably take us 3 8-hour days or 10-hour days or whatever we end up agreeing on,
right,
to record those 3 songs.
Yeah.
And then it'll take me this long to get you some mixes to give me revisions on, or to send back revision notes on.
Right.
But I'm also going to have a limit on how long it'll take, or how I'm not going to leave a limit to how many revisions anymore, but I'm going to have a time limit as to how long you can't email me back before I just won't do it.
Right.
Because if a band, like if I give a band a mix and they take 2 weeks before they get back to me with revision notes, I'm just going to have to say, like, I'm sorry, but
yeah,
you had 2 weeks.
I've been thinking about that, as I start doing more, analog mixes,
mm-hmm,
or I start doing more analog recall specifically.
Well, that takes time to do, mm-hmm, if you're doing an analog mix.
And I'm trying to do as much in the box as I can, unless I know the client is either A, going to attend the mixing sessions,
mm-hmm,
or B, they're going to be okay with whatever mix I send them. Right. Right. And I always do, you know, 3 or 4 versions of any analog mix I do anyway.
Right.
Cause I'm trying to get automation rights, or maybe I want to do one with the vocal hotter or vocal buried or whatever.
Yeah.
But
I'm going to not be going into the analog world because of,
of recall.
Recalls. Yeah.
Specifically. Yeah.
I will not go into the analog world until there's like an affordable analog hybrid system on my computer, it will tell the device, like, these were the settings.
There used to be, I've been reading up on fader automation, installable fader automation that is controllable through Pro Tools,
mm-hmm,
which is a Huey-ish device anyway.
Yeah.
And so Mackie used to have an affordable alternative that you could install fader by fader, and it would connect through Ethernet into Pro Tools using the Huey protocol.
Sure.
And there was another company that had another affordable. Now, these guys always talked about affordable in different ways.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly what affordable was, but they were comparing it to like the Martin Sound flying faders,
mm-hmm,
and that kind of stuff, which is like, that's, you know, that's,
well, flying faders is one thing, but like I would want like my EQs on every channel strip to also just automatically shift.
That's never going to happen.
Yeah. I know that's not going to happen.
If you're going
to
use,
that's going to be a huge thing.
If you're
going to
use a digital console, then right. But
I don't see myself using a digital console.
Yeah,
I see myself using a controller.
Yep.
And I would love to upgrade from my Mackie MCU someday.
Did you? Well, I don't think this is an upgrade, but Behringer has released or is releasing an 8-channel fader pack expansion to their X-Touch. And if they weren't so fucking colorful in the lights, I would be all over that shit. Because with the lights off, they look pretty nice.
But then the lights turn on.
The lights turn on and it's all
rainbows and shit.
Yeah. And that's why I didn't buy a Midas and I bought a Soundcraft instead. Yeah.
I don't mind color as long as it makes sense.
But I was talking about the recall. Mm-hmm. And revisions, and I've decided that if I'm doing an analog mix where I have to do recall, then it's 1-2 revisions maximum.
That's fair.
But digital mixes...
Recall is a pain in the
ass. A bitch, right? Yeah. But digital mixes, I'm... someone's calling me from Sundry. Should we start taking calls on air? That would be funny.
Probably not.
But digital mixes, I've been doing upwards of 6 or 7 revisions as bands want to hear, oh, let's try it without this and let's try it with this. And
yeah, that's fair.
I had a hip hopper the other day, just yesterday, in fact, that wanted less auto-tune.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Could they actually sing?
No. I mean, they weren't far off, but they needed the help. So we just minimized the effect.
So less auto-tune robot effects, more natural sound. Okay.
Yeah. He also tried to get me, I realize sometimes where my limitations are.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to get me to create the voice slowing down 3 bars before it was supposed to stop. And he wanted a gradual slow down, like the tape was slowing down.
Okay.
He just wanted it on the voice. He didn't want the beat to change. He just wanted it on the voice.
So he wanted like a tape stop on the voice.
Which I had. Yeah. I had on the voice. We had the last like two beats.
Yeah.
Stop. The beat stops. Pick up on the next vocalist. And it sounded really great. It sounded really punchy, but he was like, why can't we start that really like just, you know, back like 3 or 4 lines. For one, that's going to sound weird. Why would you do that? I just want to hear it. And for two, I don't actually know how to do that. I tried automating a couple of the tools that I have that do it.
Right.
And I stopped short at rewriting all of the vocal vocal pitch correction to be that, but I just don't know how to do it.
Yeah. If you're going for a tape stop isn't that slow.
I think he was going for more for the, like a record slowing down type of effect. But I mean the same thing, but he just wanted it drawn out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, I ended up saying no to it that, you know, one of the reasons you've hired me is because I'm cheap, but one of the reasons I'm cheap is because I don't do a lot of hip hop. And
I don't do a lot of automation.
I don't, well, I can do a lot of automation. I don't mind doing a lot of automation, but I don't know a lot of the tricks.
Yeah.
Right. And you need to go to a specialist if you want all the tricks, because they specialize in all the tricks. And so that's definitely one of my limitations, which is fine. Cause
I mean, as long as you're up front, honest, and tell them, like, I'm cheap, and this is why I'm cheap.
Which I think I was, and he didn't seem put off by it.
Okay.
Which is good.
Good.
Yeah.
I hate having the conversation of, like, you know, you come to me because I am this price, and I'm this price because of these things here.
Right.
And I hate the conversations where it's like,
but why won't you just do it?
It's like, well, then why don't you pay me more money?
Yeah. Yeah. I had an interesting mix challenge on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Spent the weekend mixing a kind of a classic rock, blues rock band Been working with them for a while. We're finally getting around to the mixes, and they send me this. They have this one track that's got a horn section, two distorted guitars, an organ, and a piano. And the organ and the piano are both VSTs, but performed by a real person.
Right.
Except the piano sound is really, really, really aggressive and is lacking a lot of subtlety and nuance. So clearly they didn't pick up the right sample bank. Mm-hmm. It was just way too aggressive. So I fought with that a long time, but more so I fought with getting the horns and the piano to sit in with the guitars and have everything clear.
Yep.
And the thing that made it, this was totally a rookie move on my part for not doing this in the first place, but I tried to not take out a ton of low end in either of them, because without some nice low end, the horns and this piano, excuse me, sounded really honky and gross.
Mm-hmm.
Until I realized that I was taking all this low end out in solo.
Oh.
And so I'm listening to this mix, and there's too much low end, and it's just all kind of not sitting right, and everything sounds too forward, nothing's sitting back properly, and I'm fighting, and I'm my retarded brain is I apologize for the use of that word. My brain is insisting that I go to the high, to the top end and cut highs and some mids out of it,
mm-hmm.
not wanting to touch the low end. And finally, I don't know what caused me to go there, but I just start slowly rolling up the high pass filter on the horns, and I realize, oh, I'm not hearing a difference. So I keep rolling it up, and I get to 200, and I still don't hear a difference, and I keep rolling it up, and I finally get to 315.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly the horns just magically sit in their right spot.
Come on, man. It's like 101.
I know, right? Anyway, so it was like instantly the horn and the piano. And I mean, I did the same thing to the piano, and they sound gross in solo, but I did the same thing to the piano, and it just started sitting so nicely there.
A lot of my favorite tricks that I do on things sound terrible by themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like my guitar tones is usually like two or three different amps that sound like shit by themselves. But then when you malt them together,
they're giving you what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Even like my bass trick, like if you were to solo any of those aspects that I do to that, like it would sound weird.
Right.
But the fact that I do it, it combines into a much more controllable, and I can do a lot more with the tone of the bass, which is very important to any song, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. That was another thing I fought with, was this guy's tone was direct out of the amp.
Okay.
Direct out of the head, not the...
He had a direct out of the head?
Yeah.
Huh.
And he was overdriving the head just a little bit, which on its own wasn't terrible. Right. So they did a lot of their own recording at their own private studio, right?
Right.
And sent me tracks.
Okay.
But the... the bass tone was very, very, it sounded like a, you know, like a poorly EQ'd head, really. That's probably not even fair, but it had lots of huge low end, but also lots of
presence
of upper mids.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I mean, it's kind of where the presence of the bass is ish. Mm-hmm. Right. one of the tracks, they bounced it out, but clearly didn't, they turned all the other tracks down. This is how they were bouncing tracks is they weren't consolidating tracks. They were just bouncing them out through the main bus, through the two bus, right?
Okay.
So
they would like,
they would turn
down
all
the faders, yeah, and just have the one track soloed and then render it.
Except they weren't soloing anything, but it was just playing by itself. But this one track they sent me clearly had all the other tracks just lightly in the background.
Yeah. So they didn't pull the faders down far enough
all the way. Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty funny.
That's funny.
Yeah. It ended up working. I mean, it was quite enough that it didn't make a difference, but
yeah. Which DAW were they using?
Pro Tools.
Okay, that explains why they did it that way.
Yeah. And they're none of them are Pro Tools experts.
No.
You know, they're just
like, how long did it take Pro Tools to have that feature where you could bounce individual tracks?
Yeah.
Like that's a recent thing.
Yeah.
Whereas every other DAW has had it for years.
Yeah. 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 Anyway, I mean, we ended up getting everything and it ended up sounding fine. As soon as we're done this podcast, I'm going through the final revisions before I send them tracks, but, tell me what you think of this. I started doing a new thing with reverb because just on this project, I couldn't get the reverb to sit right for anything because the drummer is not he's a really light hitter.
Okay.
And so the drums don't quite sound right-ish. But I started fighting with reverb
right
on all the songs.
Yep.
So I started doing this on the last song and I'm going back and trying to do this on the rest of them. I started doing the reverb in solo.
Okay.
On each instrument. I'm doing 2 to 3 different reverbs on each instrument. One is a little bit of room because they're all pretty dry tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And then a plate just kind of mixed in to give it
some space.
Some space. And so I've been just making each instrument sound like I would want it to sound on its own.
Right.
And then that's the reverb. And that's been working out really nicely. It's it gives a sense of space, but not a lot of audible reverb.
Hmm.
Yeah. How do you usually build your reverbs, ambiences?
I have like usually 3 or 4 auxiliary channels with reverbs.
With different types of reverbs to see what works?
Yeah. I might have like 2 channels that have the same plug-in, but it'll be probably different kind of sounds, right, either a hall or a plate or whatever I decide I'm going to use. Ultimately, like the reverbs are just there for me to experiment as needed.
Mm.
Like usually on each one of those tracks, I have like every single one of my reverb channels and they're all just bypassed.
Right.
And then I just turn on as I see fit. But I also have an EQ before and after and I'll EQ stuff just to shape the reverb to fit in the mix.
Right.
Or the send. 'Cause like I don't need below 200 Hertz or well, on most things, I don't need below 200 Hertz being fed into the reverb.
Right.
Then I usually also have some, delays on their own send,
oh, yeah,
but sometimes those delays will send to a reverb.
Well.
Yeah. But no, I don't usually solo them. I'll sometimes solo the track and then it'll just give me the reverb,
yeah,
and I'll listen to it. But that's usually when I'm trying to time the, like it's usually like
time
I have a delay
or something
and yeah, I want the delay to be in time with the song.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And then sometimes I do the same with the reverb is I'll make the tail a certain note length.
Yeah.
So that it's more musical.
Hmm.
So I kind of do it.
Okay.
Majority of what I do though is I just shape the reverb.
How do you try to sit the reverb in the track?
I don't know. That's a tough one because
so it depends so much by feel, right?
Yeah. Sometimes I'm drowning things in reverb. Other times I'm fairly dry and hiding it. A trick I've been doing lately, just because I think it sounds cool, is sending my kick drum, of all things, to a reverb.
Right.
But then having a gate that's sidechained with also the kick. So okay. Then you only get reverb when the kick is in. And then there is no tail for the reverb, but I make the reverb huge, it like a massive space. And like normally you'd have like a mile long tail.
Okay.
So like the gate is making that tail not be as big.
Right.
And I usually have to have that tail as big to get that big reverb sound. Right. So I'm doing that, making this huge reverb, but then using a gate to close the reverb.
Is the reverb only on the kick, or is there reverb on everything or a lot of things?
There might be like a snare that also is using that reverb,
right?
But it's just to give both the like, it's just to give those elements like a bigger size,
sure,
to them. And I find it pretty successful in doing so without like cluttering my mix.
Neat. Now, is that for that kind of gated reverb sound? Is that the idea?
I got the idea from
like
experimenting with gated reverbs. I'm not necessarily going for that sound.
Right.
But it is an idea that I derived from it.
Sure. Yeah.
Sometimes I'm just doing it to make the kick drum sound bigger.
Okay. I gotcha. Yeah. I am so easy to make them sound smaller too, right?
Well, like, especially if you do things that I do where like they're compressed to hell and like EQ'd to hell and back. Mm-hmm. So then I need to add some life back into them. So I put a reverb on there.
Right.
And then I manipulate the reverb so that it's not cluttering my mix.
One of the things I've been experimenting with is I've been bringing a mic into the control room.
Mm-hmm.
Two mics specifically. I try to do it in like RTF stereo type of thing. Sit them about where my head sits.
Mm-hmm.
And then re-recording my mix through that with that slight delay.
Right.
And then just blending a little bit of that back in. It's a really, really neat, interesting.
I can definitely see that being interesting for sure.
Yeah. And where I got the idea from was I have those AKG open back headphones. They're basically tied to the desk. And I would at times, if people are talking in the control room, I'd at times just put them on so I can, you know, eliminate the people talking.
Right.
Right. And so that would create this slight delay in the two signals.
Yeah.
And it would have a really interesting depth effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd pull off the headphones and be like, oh, this is not as nice. So
you started to record it.
I did. And it sounds, it's a really, really nice little thing if you blend it in just subtly.
Yeah, that does sound like a subtle.
Ooh, you're getting a phone call. This is awesome. Who's calling you?
I don't know, an 800 number.
Huh. They probably want money.
Probably.
Yeah. That's going to come more often as you open up your space.
Eh.
Yeah. Hey, so one of the things we kind of started talking about, but I gave you shit for talking about it before the podcast, was you were thinking about changing
my plan to have a editing suite so that I had a space to work in as the space was being rented if it got that popular.
Right.
I was also thinking if I had a big enough project, I could hire somebody on to just work in the editing suite while I'm recording and then edit.
How likely do you think that is?
Not very likely at first.
Yeah, fair enough.
If the studio were to build into something where I could make it a full-time thing, maybe I would have like
right.
a person that I have on the payroll to be.
Payroll suck, man. Don't go payroll. Contract work.
Well, regardless.
Well, like, however you do it.
Someone in the studio to be like to do the stuff like editing while I'm focusing with the band type of thing. Because right. like I don't mind editing, but at the same time, if this is a project that I need to be quickly on the go, I might need somebody who just they're in the other room.
Right.
Putting things together, and then when it's done, he can show me, I can approve the edits.
Right.
And then when that's done, I could be like, here's this song, do that now. And just focus with the band. Like that was part of my idea, but
right.
I know that's like pretty far, or that's a lot of forward thinking going on. By the time I grow to that size, chances are I'll be building a proper commercial space instead of a home studio.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you're not that far off from doing that though.
Building a commercial space.
Yeah. Or taking over a commercial space. Maybe.
Possibly. Yeah. I need to have the critical mass of work though.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Learn from my mistakes. Don't build a $50,000.
Well, people keep telling me like that I should maybe just build like rent a space. And I'm constantly having to have this conversation and be like, I know a lot of people who did that and are in a lot of trouble because of it.
Yeah. Well, the Resonate model seems to be one of the best ones. They built their entire business around music school and then included a recording studio in there, and they've become really successful enough that they have two locations now. Right.
Right.
I think they still only have the one studio, but that model, it's largely driven by the music students.
Yeah, well, students is a great business, especially right now. Like, there's a lot of people wanting to learn how to play instruments.
Yeah.
But I don't really have an interest in running a school.
Yeah, well, I mean, that kind of thing would be best if you partnered up with someone who is interested.
Yeah.
Right.
No, if I had somebody who would be okay managing that side of the business, I'd maybe venture into that and diversify my income streams that way.
Yeah.
But I don't have any interest in managing that stuff.
That's totally fair.
The only things I'm kind of interested in is like obviously having a recording space.
Yeah.
But I would also be interested in having rehearsal spaces and managing that side of things too.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in supporting creators of music. And while I think teaching is important, I just don't have the interest to also venture into that side of things.
Well, and that is the studio and rehearsal space. That's another one of those proven
models,
business models.
And I was, lately, I've been like fixated on Rosdale Power Plant?
Rosdale Power Plant?
You know that power plant downtown?
No. I mean, maybe I do, but
with the smokestacks and stuff, it doesn't run anymore. Like, they don't use it as a power plant anymore.
Okay.
And right now, they're trying to decide what they're going to do with that property.
Rosdale Power Plant. Comes up on Google.
Sure, it's Rosdale. It's right on the river.
Oh, that's the one right beside the baseball diamond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in that area. So right now it's not being used for anything. And they're asking people what they want it to be used for. And it's been suggested that it should be for the arts community and the Aboriginal community.
Yeah.
Because it is like a sacred land to the Aboriginals. And I think that would be great if that could be turned into something.
Right.
And I think that would be a cool space to have a recording studio and a rehearsal space built into.
That would be a pretty cool thing. Yeah. Have you ever been inside?
Nope.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at the outside and going like, this is cool.
It has Epcor's name on the side of it. Is it possible that Epcor still owns the building, or is it a City of Edmonton property? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I just know that there's a revitalization thing going on where they're deciding whether or not they should tear down the building, which I don't think they should. It's a historical building at this point.
Is the water treatment plant still active as well?
I'm not sure.
I could read this. I could read this article, I'm sure, but
yeah. Probably wouldn't make for good radio.
Exactly.
Regardless, I was looking into it. It's got, like, from the outside, it's got vibe. And so if you could make the inside have vibe, and there was other businesses in that building.
Yeah.
Like, there's been people saying, make it into an Aboriginals museum. And I think that would be cool. And, like, have other art spaces in there, too.
You know... Grant McEwen's West Campus here that the city is now taking over.
Yeah.
Calling it the Orange Hub, right? Both of those recording studios are open, and they're trying to rent them out as recording studios.
Okay.
They're unequipped, but they're not terribly priced.
The city's taking it over?
The city's already taken it over. They're already leasing it out to certain people. And so it's got two studios in there, right? It's got the big one that is, I think it's just a little bigger than us.
Okay.
But with only like one control room, one tracking room, right?
Right.
And then they have the smaller one, which is based on the dimensions on the graph. You know what? I can send you all this information because I was in talks with them last month.
Okay.
The smaller one has a smaller control room than I have. Not by much, but, and then tracking room about the size of the yellow room downstairs.
Okay.
And the prices aren't terrible, but it's already built. It's already up and going.
You just need to equip it.
Just need to equip it. That's right.
So they're actually like actively looking for people to take over that space?
Actively looking for people to take over the space. That's right. You just have to, submit a proposal, and they have certain terms that you have to agree to.
Right.
But yeah.
It's interesting.
It was a really interesting option. If, there were a couple of things that made me not stop considering it. Namely the timeline, like they had to have, I had to have an application in within just a few days of me starting to talk.
Jesus.
Well, and that was just, they run on, I think it's quarterly or something. They run on an application process, right?
So the quarter was about to be done.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that's totally fair. I didn't put any of that on them, but
yeah.
But yeah, it was they don't look terrible.
Right.
They don't have a lot of vibe. But that would be something that is easy to bring in, right?
Mm-hmm. So
yeah. But that's, I'll, remind me and I'll send you over the documents. Cause there's a lot of good information in there about it.
Yeah. I would love to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know how prepared I would be to do something like that.
It doesn't, I don't expect they'd be taken over very quickly. Just because it is in the art space or in the hub, whatever. Right.
Yeah.
But it might be one of those things that's perfect for, you know, like a community of engineers to take over.
Yeah.
One or both. Oh.
And I guess we're finishing up.
Thanks everybody. I guess we'll see y'all next time with more interesting talk about whatever it is that we do. Should we do that?
Sure.
We're really early. I I feel all flustered.
Follow our hosts on Twitter at Two Bodies of Water.
You got that mic in a comfortable spot yet?
I'm still working on it.
At Joey R. Engineer.
I can't even talk.
I don't remember what my point was.
This is a boring podcast.
I realize at the end of this, we didn't introduce ourselves.
On to the internet you go. Go switch off.